it is meant to be an open discussion among Christian folk dealing with the theme of breaking the silence, learning from one another how to speak about the unspeakable. Just a quick word about what I understand to be the format for a discussion like that, or like this. We have an hour. We will create a definite break at 10 o'clock. If there are people who want to stay and continue to talk, we're welcome to do that, and we're certainly welcome to carry on the discussion throughout the week or the days that we have here. Two things by way of a brief introduction. Last evening, as people were gathering to who were interested in planning this discussion, a friend came up to me and asked what I was doing. I said we're preparing to have this time tonight for this topic. He said, you know, there are things that are so difficult for me that I simply can't talk about them. And I asked him if he would share one example of that. And he said, I simply can't talk about child abuse. I get so angry that I can't possibly talk about it. Well, certainly anger is one of the things that creates the difficulty for speaking about unspeakable things. Others are certainly fear and ignorance, and the list could be quite long, and I'm sure we'll share out of our own experiences tonight. So there is a need for us to have these opportunities to talk. The second, that there is a hope, occurred in a beautiful way yesterday while I was waiting to talk to Dale Boland, who is going to share briefly tonight by way of getting us started. Dale, as you perhaps know, has one leg. And while I was waiting to talk with him, Timothy, a 7-year-old, was doing a beautiful job of speaking about something that perhaps many of us regard as unspeakable, in asking very specific, very interested, very direct kinds of questions. How do you take off your artificial leg? Do you only buy one shoe? What do you do with the other sock? How did you lose your leg? And Dale, the partner in this dialogue, was answering very directly, and it led to the place where Timothy suggested Dale could stay at his house sometime if he ever needed to, and his conclusion was marvelous, and that is that a person with one leg might have a wonderful life. This from a 7-year-old. The little child will lead us. Well, there's a number of people who are going to make brief kinds of sharing statements. They will be in this kind of an order. Dale Jampgard, who has helped us in so many ways during the time he's here, is going to say just a few things about perhaps why we avoid speaking about things that are threatening to us. We have with us Rebecca Parker, who is a Methodist minister, who has done a great deal of ministry with people who have suffered violence. So she will be one of those kind of speaking out of experience of ministry. We have a brother with us, Frank Lowland, who is a gay Christian brother who will speak out of his experience, helping us to perhaps understand ways in which a gay people might like to be able to have conversation and to speak with others in the body of Christ. Dale is someone who has prepared himself to be able to speak about the threat of nuclear war with others. And then we have Paul Bosch, who is an artist and can help us see how the arts deal with this. And finally, Mark Olson, who is a pastor, is going to touch on why the congregation ought and can be the place for this kind of work. There are others who have been expressed interest in this. Cheryl, who works in feminist issues and in international relations, and Pierre Fayetana. But we have a wealth here. We're going to try to move through these brief sharings so that we can get into the discussion. So Dale, would you please get us into the discussion?
Okay. You who have eyes to see, why don't you see? You who have ears to hear, why don't you hear? Says Jesus. And what he's referring to is our selective senses and our selective memory. That as we grow in life, out of our anxiety, we create a view of the world. And our safety often depends, we believe, on seeing the world that way. And that's why if you have different reports of an incident, each one sees a different thing. If two people go to a movie, they each see a different movie. Because we select out of the movie what we're willing to let in to our worldview, what fits for us. So just as individuals, we often lock experiences within us that we actually forget about, lock from our memory because they are too painful to include in our worldview. We block from our view and from our senses things that don't fit for us, things that don't make sense or fit our worldview. That also happens then in families and in societies. An example of that may be the attitudes towards death in our American society. In many ways, we have tried to hide death. And so it's no wonder children get confused because they hear someone fell asleep or they're resting in peace and no one said that they died. And we tend to avoid it and not deal with death for what it is, but make it look as gentle and peaceful and quiet and nice as possible. So that's kind of an example. What I think we're going to touch on tonight then is we're going to go towards those conditions that do exist around us and in our lives. And we can dare do that because there is one that's gone before us. And that is Jesus walks into the depths of the darkness and invites us to walk with him in order that we might come through to the victory of the resurrection. And in that light, have the courage to face anything that happens in life. Hopefully we will be able to share those things then that we hesitate to talk about and deal with.
Great. Thanks, Dale, very much. Rebecca, would you like to begin with...
When I became a pastor, I discovered that people come and tell pastors secrets that they haven't told anyone else. And one of the shocks for me when I first began in the ministry was how many people have very deep and very painful secrets that they hold inside of themselves. The secrets that people keep are often, keeping the secret is very destructive in a person's life a lot of times because a pain is buried and held inside that could be healed if it were exposed or opened up. I've learned that for every person who keeps a secret, there's someone else or a group of other people who have threatened that person into keeping the secret. And oftentimes, it's the Christian community itself that threatens others into keeping silence. And so I'd like to tell just a couple stories about secrets people have kept and what's happened to them when they've, what they've gone through in deciding to reveal the secret. And maybe these will be sort of like case studies for our further discussion. First story I'd like to tell is about a person who I'll call Karen. Karen was someone I had known for about 10 years before I had this experience with her. We had gone to college together, then we went to seminary together. We were both ordained to be United Methodist ministers and were serving neighboring churches. One evening we were both at a church meeting. It was a week-long church meeting, And Karen came to me and she said, I really need to talk. Would you be willing to get some of the clergy women together and meet me in my room tonight? I have something I need to talk about. And I said, sure. So I gathered together some friends and we sat down in Karen's room in the evening. And we sat there for about an hour while Karen hemmed and hawed and beat around the bush. And she said, thank you for coming. I'm not sure I can say what I want to say. I really appreciate you all being here. And then she talked about how hard it was to talk about what she had to say, but she didn't tell us anything for a long time. And so we tried to give her as much support as we could, and we gave her, made some tea, and told her that it would be better to talk than to not talk. And finally she started to cry. And she cried for a long time, and her friends put their arms around her. And after she cried for a long time, she started to vomit. And we helped her and stayed with her. And then, after she had vomited, she said, I've never told anyone before. But from when I was 5 until when I was 18, my father sexually abused me. She said, the reason I feel like I have to say this now is because I left my 6-year-old daughter with my father when I came to this meeting. And I suddenly realized that my daughter might not be safe. So then she went on to talk for a long time about what had happened, and we all listened. And as it turned out, her young daughter was abused by her grandfather during that week. So the family, Karen and her husband, after talking with their daughter, decided to press charges against Karen's father. When they pressed charges, when they lifted the issue up in the whole family, the rest of the members of the family accused them of trying to destroy the family. And Karen's sister came to her and said, our father abused me too, but I'm not going to tell anyone. Why do you have to talk about this? The town, small town in which the family lived, the town paper started running stories about how awful it was that this man was being accused. He was a high school guidance counselor and a member of the state legislature. The case went to court and he was vindicated of any guilt. The reason he was vindicated of any guilt was that the 6-year-old child on the witness stand, confronted face to face with her grandfather, was unable to testify against him. That's one story. Another story I'd like to tell is about a friend of mine named Bill. Bill grew up in a little tiny church back east. It was one of those rural churches where he was a Methodist too. I'm sorry, I'm telling you a Lutheran story. We could pretend. It's like a Lutheran. It's one of those little 100-member rural churches where it's a close-knit church family and kids grow up together. And Bill grew up in this church. He was a very shy child, but very bright and talented. And he said that his parents were the pillars of the church. And if it wasn't for the church, he might have never become anything, he said, in his life. But the other people in the church offered him a lot of support and love as a growing child. And he said he remembers when he was about 10 years old that the music teacher in the church convinced him to come join the choir. And he really loved music and turned out to have a great singing voice. And so that was the beginning of him developing his talent as a musician. And then when he was in junior high school, another adult in the church who recognized that though he was shy, he was a deep person, talked him into becoming the president of the youth group. And so he was president of the youth group for 3 years. And He said it really changed him because he found out he could lead other people and that he had something to contribute, and he really drew him out of his shell, and he became more interested in life and committed. And then he went away to college, but all of the people in his home church kept encouraging him to go into the ministry. And he felt very strongly that God was calling him to go into the ministry, but he wasn't sure that he thought he was too shy to do that. And so he kind of put it off, and he put it off, and he went into music instead and became a tenor and did a lot of singing, but he said that just never could let go of that feeling that God was calling him into the ministry. So he went to seminary, and while he was at seminary, he found a very loving and supportive community of other people. And he said that the people gave him so much, told him so often that he was a person of worth and value and accepted in God's eyes, and the community communicated that to him so much that he finally was able to tell himself the truth about himself, which was that he knew that he was a gay man. He said, if it hadn't been for that loving Christian community, I never could have accepted myself. But in that community, I did. And so he told his friends at the seminary he was gay, and they said that they were with him and supported him. And so he was ordained as a minister and assigned to a small rural church like the one he grew up in. And he was had a great time with the people in this rural community. He was very gifted at speaking, and he used his music in the church to enrich the worship life. But he felt that he was not really able to love the people because he couldn't tell them and hadn't told them who he was, really. So he went to his bishop, and he told the bishop he was gay. And the bishop said, thank you, we no longer need you in the United Methodist Church. And he was asked to turn in his credentials and his ordination papers and leave the ministry. And he left the church and for many years has lived without Christian community because, as he said to me once, the very community that told me I was loved and accepted and had gifts that were valuable, in the end, rejected me. I think that both of these stories illustrate the struggle that people go through to tell their secrets. It means overcoming the fear of rejection. But the stories also reveal that the threats that have kept people silent are often enforced when people break silence. And part of the problem of breaking silence is for all of us to recognize when we are participating in threatening others into silence. And last very brief thing I'd like to say is that the theologian named Nell Morton talks about something that she calls hearing other people into speech. And she says that the quality of our listening can liberate other people to tell the truth. And in the same way, the quality of our listening can imprison people in silence.
Thank you, Rebecca. Frank, would you please continue, and we'll try to keep the statements brief, but thank you. You opened up a number of very good things. And then Dale, following Frank.
My name is Frank Ulan. I'm a member of a Lutheran congregation in Phoenix, Arizona. From the time I was in grade school, I knew that I was somehow different than the other kids in school. I wrestled with that over a long period of time. Somewhere in my teens, I realized that I must be gay. I spent a number of nights praying and crying, unable to talk to anyone, asking God to change me, because I knew I couldn't be like the stories I'd heard from the other kids in school. I knew that just wasn't the way I was. I was scared to death to talk to anyone. I don't specifically remember any condemning statements that I heard made in church when I was growing up. But for a lot of people, not hearing anything condemning is not enough. When you're dealing with something as intimate a part of yourself as your sexuality, and you don't hear anything that's supported, all you can think back to is the jokes that you heard when you were in grade school, in high school, what all the other kids said. If you happen to look at the Bible, you may not be able to make sense out of the passages that seem to pertain to homosexuality. I went through a period that spanned about, well, over 15 years, struggling with the issue, trying to work through the issue on my own. As I said, I didn't feel like going to my pastor. I didn't feel like going to my parents. I had very loving parents. But I did not feel that that was something I could talk to them about. I have worked through most of those issues, most of those problems now. I'm now open in my congregation, open at work, open with my family. Most of the reactions I've gotten from people have been positive. I've been very fortunate. I haven't lost a job. I don't feel that I've been terribly discriminated against, and I've not been subject to physical violence or too much verbal abuse. But I think the church, as I say, needs to say something positive. Silence is not good enough. This is too intimate a part of who I am as a gay person and who each of you are as a gay or straight person, as the case may be. For a straight person, it's accepted as being the norm. Doesn't need to be talked about. It's reinforced by things such as marriage. For a gay person, it does need to be talked about, and it's not reinforced by anything except being able to talk with other people one-on-one, such as a pastor or someone else in the congregation or your parents, and to be told that that's okay. We love the way you are.
Thank you, Frank. Dale?
I've got to stand up to talk here. Jerry asked me to wear this shirt tonight. I want to stand up so you can all see that picture there. And if you can't read the words, it says, "Imagine a world beyond war." 42 years ago this month, I was in a hospital in Texas, being fitted with an artificial leg. I'd been over in the Alsace-Lorraine area. This is World War II. Had been captured and wounded and lost a leg. I had fought in a war that I was told, and I believe, was a war to end all wars. And even though I had lost a leg, I felt great because I'd been part of that Allied effort that had defeated the Nazis, and we were on the verge of defeating the Japanese. And we were all welcomed home with waving flags, and it was a good feeling. A few years later, as we built our home, in fact, this was about 12 years later, we considered putting a bomb-proof room in the basement. And a few years after that, it was the atom bombs and the nuclear weapons were building up, I got to the point where I didn't even want to talk about war. We have 3 children grown now, and now 3 grandchildren. And until 3 years ago, I buried my head in the sand, I think, like a lot of other folks, refusing to think of the consequences of a nuclear war. 3 years ago, in fact, it was in Roost's house, all that I heard a presentation by a group called Beyond War. The Beyond War people, and it's a movement that's been underway for 8 or 10 years out of Palo Alto, California, believe that, first of all, we're people of planet Earth. We have limited resources. We're all interrelated in the way we live, and we've got to preserve these resources. The second belief is that with the development of nuclear weapons, war has become obsolete, and we have to find a way to live here on planet Earth without war. To do that, we have to resolve our conflicts in peaceful ways. And that begins, and that's part of the pledge as a member of Beyond War, that I'll live with little or no conflict in my life. Even when the fellow cuts in front of me on the freeway and I have to slam on the brakes, I'm not going to think angry thoughts. When Phyllis gets up on the wrong side of the bed and says the wrong word, I'm going to subdue that tendency to talk back to her, sort of thing. I wore a little pin here that has a view of planet Earth as seen from outer space. And there's a gold ring around the outside, and that's the symbol of people working together to move beyond war.
Thanks, Dale. Paul Bosch is an artist, and perhaps artists have always been on the edge of dealing with these things.
I like to think that part of my job here tonight would be to remind us that we have guilty secrets and things that we're ashamed of and things that we're afraid to mention at the corporate level too, and at the level of society and even civilizations. In the years 1936-1937, the Spanish Civil War was raging, and one evening for the first time, I think, in warfare, planes from Franco's army, which were the loyalists, bombed a Spanish village called Guernica. And Pablo Picasso, you know the name Picasso, famous artist, living, I think, in exile then already in France, was inspired to paint an immense mural with the name of that Spanish town as a protest to war. And the only picture I could find of it in the village is this little one, but I'll pass it around. I've seen the real thing in the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. It's good to know now it's going back to Spain, where it belongs. But for many, many years, it was in the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. And it's huge. It's a wall. It's as big, at least, as those two, as the space between those two piers. And it shows a dismembered warrior and a wounded horse screaming and a woman mourning over her baby that's dead and another woman in a flaming building. It's just a picture of horrors. And it's all in black and white and gray. There's no color in it. And this is one artist, I think, trying to name the unnameable and to say what a dreadful thing even so-called conventional war can be. I'm put in mind also of two recent movies, one Platoon. I wonder if any of you have seen Platoon. A couple of them. How about The Untouchable? Any of you have seen The Untouchable? Both splendid examples of movie making, and both of them end with a very ambiguous and yet I think also insightful statement by the artists who made those movies. In the case of Platoon, the suggestion that maybe at the end of the movie that maybe we really didn't belong there. And the protagonist of the movie, the young soldier who gets his eyes opened on the battlefield, and there's a lot of blood and gore. You don't want to go see it if you have a weak stomach. But the movie is full of blood and gore, and nice people get killed. And the hero at the end of the story says, I was fighting with part of my soul. I mean, he was almost describing a civil war within himself. And I think that's what it was. As for the Untouchables, Elliot Ness, as you may know, is the Force of Righteousness and the FBI trying to get Al Capone in the Prohibition days in Chicago. And the end of that movie, too, has Elliot Ness having put Al Capone away for tax evasion, of all things, and not for his other crimes. Another bloody movie, just full of gore. But I regard the artist as making the statement here to show that this kind of stuff is pretty terrible. And Elliot Ness saying, well, golly, I use some of the same methods in defeating Capone that Capone used. Mm. And it suggests, again, the violence that's at the heart of Western civilization and certainly the American experience, which I regard as a guilty secret that we really ought to be talking about. Jesus comes among us as prophet, priest, and king. And I like to think of those three roles as having been shared with us. And the priestly word is yes. And that's the word that affirms and supports and defends everything in this world that is worth affirming and supporting and defending. And I hear Christ calling us to that responsibility, to be priests in our world and to say yes. That's a conservative word. A more radical word, and that's the prophetic no. No, I think, is the prophet's word. And the prophet has to come into the situation and say no wherever the prophet sees our inhumanity to each other and where everything is not right. And the arts in recent years, not only painting, but movies and plays and music and all of them, it seems to me, have been preoccupied, and I think understandably so and justifiably so, with speaking the prophetic no. As for the kingly word, that's amen, and that's another sermon, and I'll tell you about that later.
Thanks, Paul. Mark, help us begin to talk as the people of God.
I think the congregation, community, the faith community, is the arena in which there is permission, and more than permission, it's almost is the place where the unspeakable can be spoken. There's a couple gifts that we are given as a faith community to enable that to happen. One is the cross, which is probably the most unspeakable. And it is spoken in our midst. And when we mark ourselves and name ourselves with that, it seems to me that we have spoken the most unspeakable word. And thus all other words are sort of consumed and seen in light of that one. And there is sort of permission then to speak the others. The second gift that we are given is the gift of ritual. Ritual helps us order the chaos, helps us provide means and avail ourselves to things that otherwise are too difficult for us to handle. I'm doing a project now in Colorado with Lutheran Social Services of Colorado, developing rituals for birth mothers who are giving their children up for adoption. I accidentally fell into it, and I didn't understand the kind of gift those primarily poor, young women give when they choose not to have abortions, but to carry that child full term and then give that child up in adoption. They choose life. Tremendous pain. And we are trying to develop rituals, and they want the church. Many of these people are not associated with the church. They want the church to be there to help them because of the transcendence, because of the power, because of the structure of life that comes from the church, to help them say goodbye, the most unspeakable word that they can say to their child. And to say to their child through them that they love that child and that they've birthed this child and given this child away because they love them. Not because they are sort of people who don't care. The church is the place that can and should and must be the arena, it seems to me, to speak those unspeakable words.
Okay, thanks to all. And now it's an open time for us to respond, to open up other aspects, raise questions. and for us to be able to speak with one another. So let's find. Yes?
I went to a forum with the Beyond War in Tacoma. It was two women psychologists or psychiatrists, that's their profession. And they were discussing the effect of knowing that the world can blow up on children, and what parents can do and what anyone can do to help children. And there it comes right into what you were saying about the train, about if you don't say it, they're still going to be thinking these things. And it was a very enlightening thing to me that you simply must say hopeful things to them. We must have hope, and there is something we can do about it. We got ourselves into this stew. We can unstew us if we want to. But we really have to want to. And there were some children there, a couple of teenagers, and they said they were very glad that their parents were actively, politically involved in trying, you know, writing letters and talking to their congressmen and writing to the president and doing everything they could think of to do, including giving talks in the community to make people think about it and then talk to the children about it, because they're scared.
I'd like to know what we can do within our parishes to open some of these things up. What is our forum? How do we get something started? I'm a layperson. I'm not directing. I'm not on a board. And I'm not going to be.
Got your time.
Smart.
She invited to a forum on magic fingers.
Could this kind of a discussion, you think, happen in your parish?
Yes.
Some say no, huh? Some say yes?
Yes.
Within certain small portions of the congregation that I belong to, yes. Within others, no.
Is it possible? I think one of the easy place to begin in a parish is in the prayers. Is to name these concerns and these passions in the prayer life of the parish. And that is a corporate, and it's a powerful way in which that it gets shared. I think it's real important that the prayers of the church speak some of the unspeakable things that we are afraid of and fear. And you may just ask your pastor to pray for some of those things. As a pastor, I'd love it if somebody called me in the middle of the week and said, "Pastor, would you include in the prayers this week prayers for the fear of nuclear war? I really am concerned about that," or whatever the case may be, or AIDS, or horrible things with AIDS, whatever the case may be. That's a safe and pretty easy way to gain access within a congregational setting, and touches a lot of people.
What's some other thoughts on that? Or
what happens if the pastor says no?
Have you had that experience?
No, I haven't. Uh-huh. But especially in dealing with more sensitive things like sexual abuse and homosexuality and things like that, and possibly even AIDS, I'm sure there's pastors that wouldn't be willing to mention any one of those in a sermon or a prayer.
I'm sure there are too.
Please.
Each one of us, by our attitude and what we are willing to affirm, make a statement which is contagious. I know of a situation where something very tragic had happened and very secretive otherwise. One of the first people who heard about it made an affirming and a supportive comment about it. Said, "Now, this is a situation where we can befriend. This is a place where we can really show some love. And if they had picked up on that instead, have you heard? And, you know, and they continued it a secret and continued to make a bad connotation with it. And the follow-up on that was that people were affirming and were supportive. So I think each one of us have sort of a responsibility for how we handle whatever comes to us.
If you hear and then hear, please, if you do raise your hand, I can get a chance to
mention.
Yeah.
Well, the unnameable was named at our church, a statement about AIDS to the effect that there may be those in the congregation who do have AIDS, and there's some concern about the common cup. So if you have any kind of, you think you might possibly have any kind of infection, please use intinction, lest you might inadvertently give something absolutely devastating to someone who might have AIDS.
Well, you mentioned the importance of being supportive and affirming, which I think is the key, because too often the church is told and the society is told it's judgmental. But of all the issues brought up here, to me the most confusing in terms of my reaction, I think the church's reaction also is the issue of homosexuality. Because that issue, to me, I have a really good friend who was a Luther son who is gay and wound up dropping out of sin. And he was my best friend in college, and I found out. But to me, that issue was, the issue of war, the issue of abuse, pretty much everybody's on one side or the other. But in that issue, you know, the church is struggling itself. And as a Christian, you know, I am not sure in my own mind on where I come down on that issue, because I've been told different biblical things, I've been told different things from different people. And it seems to me that I'd like to know how anybody who's had experience in struggling with that and on where a Christian comes down on that, because I struggle with the need to be affirming and the need to be supportive, which I am, but also I wonder how, you know, if the church can be supportive, you know, where the church needs to draw a line and say, you know, is this God's way? And I guess, I remember a few years ago when I was right, when Anita Bryant did her thing, and how I just cringe. But that to me is an issue, of all the things that have been brought up so far, the one that I struggle with most. I don't know if anybody has any way that they've dealt with that in their parish or in their ministry that they've done.
Say you're concerned with how to be affirming of.
I'm concerned with the. I'm not concerned with being affirming. I acknowledge the need to be affirming and supportive. But constantly, I'm wondering though, where in the congregation, the way that if, because to me, it can be affirming on a one-on-one level, but. Like, for example, the friend of the person who acknowledged his identity was asked to leave. To what extent do you think that a congregation in a small town or something, or even a large town, can be, well, I guess my key concern is support and affirm, yes, but is there a point where there could we support and affirm? Well, I guess that basically boils down to the moral rightness or wrongness of that act for me, and that's something I really struggle with.
Can we be supportive of the person without approving
Correct.
The action?
Yeah.
Okay.
And how do you deal with that?
Yes. My comment doesn't directly relate to that. If you want to open that question, people.
Let me give a stab at this. It seems to me part of the question is how much diversity can the church tolerate, diversity of opinion. And I hope, but it's certainly my dream and my vision for the church, that it tolerate a wide variety of opinion, including opinions that are different from my own. I wish that the church, I wish that every member of the church had the same opinion on war and peace, for instance, that I have.
But I know that is not true, and so I've had to phrase my prayers pretty carefully when I pray as pastor.
Sure.
That I can have you affirm it, even you who don't agree with me, that you can affirm my prayer. As for homosexuality, it seems to me that is one issue, and it's, I think there are some others too, but that's maybe the biggest one, where the church at this point hasn't made up its mind and has no firm or strong word to say. And I don't know whether we will for another generation or two. I think there are issues changed by the culture, by the situation, that simply press upon the church's life and require a new response. And that new response, I think, is being formulated and being worked through, but I don't see any clear consensus yet. I don't think the Anita Bryant type people are helpful. And you have the same feeling.
I have the same feeling. Mm-hmm.
I think we have to listen wherever there's pain in the world. We have to listen to the people who are pain.
It's been my experience from growing up in small Midwestern communities that, in that issue, that for one thing, people are afraid to even acknowledge it because they don't, they are afraid to affirm and support people who they view as off over there or whatever. They are afraid to maybe acknowledge their own, that they do disagree perhaps with, or they don't, not disagree, but they do not share the same orientation, but yet, but because of that, they are afraid to affirm. Maybe what I say is they need to.
You said afraid about five times. I think that's the key point.
Yeah.
My personal perspective is I'm afraid. I don't know what I feel about homosexuality. I have a gay uncle, and I've known he was gay since I was a little kid, and I was afraid of him. And I'm an adult now, and I've accepted him, and I love him, but I still personally have a fear, and I can't even describe what I'm afraid of. You know, am I afraid that I'm afraid I'm going to be gay? You know, I don't know, and I don't know how to relate that to other people, but I think that's the key.
Sarah?
I think that's something that's important in affirming a gay community is to become in touch with the normalness. To affirm a gay community is to affirm any community. And in order to be able to do that on a personal level, I don't know about a congregational level because that's a little difficult, but a personal level is just to be in tune with the gay community in your town, the gay community in the city that you live, which is threatening. It is part of the afraid to have to go to even watch a gay rights demonstration or to see that in the park next to the gay and lesbian coalition is meeting. And it's difficult to confront that, but if you just get in touch with that enough, I think that you could recognize the normalness of it and thus be affirming. Mm-hmm. I think that that's helpful.
I find that I have to continually return and return again to deal with my own sense of fear or threat, and to be touched by that community and somehow relieved. But homophobia perhaps is the deepest of the unspeakable kinds of fears that we have to contend with. I think what has been most difficult for the church has been to find the ways to enter into a kind of learning conversation and dialogue with those gay brothers and lesbian sisters who are among us. We fear even hearing from them. And I think that perhaps one of the most hopeful things that's happening now is the strengthening of Lutherans Concerned, a support group for gay and lesbian people as well as straight people. I happen to be a member of Lutherans Concerned, producing some very fine materials and opportunities for congregations and for individuals to begin to dialogue. Please. And then back to you.
Well, I think I see a problem in society today with accepting the homosexual community. It has really come up with the whole AIDS issue.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that sentiment that it's a, you know, it's God's curse on them. And we have to realize that there are a lot of straight people that have AIDS, and it's, you know, it's running rampant in Africa right now, and children have it, you know, and they didn't get it because, you know, and we have to realize that it's not a, that much of a clear, it's, the clear distinction will eventually go away, that it's a homosexual disease. And I think that really hinders society accepting the homosexual community today, because they think, I'm going to get AIDS. You know, that's the first thing they think, oh no, I'll probably get AIDS. But, you know, you can get AIDS if you're straight.
Mm-hmm. I still think the church is hung up on sex.
Yes.
Until we can get away from relating everything to sex, and that sex is the worst sin, all of that.
It's the sixth commandment, friends.
You know,
it's
not the first. And I'm 50. I mean, come on, this is getting ridiculous. We are hung up on sex. And it's not the only part of my personality. Certainly it affects my personality, but it's not the only part of me. Mm-hmm. And that's what we seem to, when we're dealing with homosexuals, that's what we seem to deal with.
Yeah. Rebecca.
I agree with that, but I wanted to say something about the fear issue. I think that I worked as a pastor of a congregation that decided to make a public statement of openness and towards lesbian and gay people. And when the church board voted to do that and announced it to the congregation, 25% of the membership left the church. And the church board discussed for a long time this question: if we say we support lesbian and gay people, what if it creates so much conflict in the congregation that people leave? Wouldn't it be wrong to alienate people from the church? Because people are afraid. And we realized, the church board realized, that they had to decide whether they were going to care more for the outcast or for the comfortable. And so they decided they would care more for the outcast because, as one of the leaders of the congregation said, if we don't act to love our neighbor, we lose our relationship with God. And if we coddle the ones who are afraid of conflict, it's in order to preserve the peace, it's our relationship with God that we'll lose. So this part of this breaking silence and taking courageous actions is deciding which relationships are the ones that are important to preserve, and that's a really painful kind of decision to make. And one of the big fears, one of the really fundamental fears people have, is losing relationships, or and creating conflict.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dale,
I'm concerned that if we, with our church the way it is, tries to deal with these specific kinds of issues, that we're really setting ourselves up for some real problems. And what I mean by this is, if we are concerned about spiritual growth, then we must be in a process of dealing with issues about how we live life, and we need to do it with one another. We need to be talking about the issues each of us are dealing with. I deepened my understanding of the grace of God most powerfully when I first went to a weekend group where we were going to be together all weekend and deal with how we lived life, and any issue was open. It just says, wherever you're at, whatever your issue is, deal with it. And I experienced a love and acceptance there that was so powerful, I began to say, now I know what the grace of God is about down here. And I haven't experienced that in the fellowship of the church, because we are afraid to be real about the issues we're dealing with and what we're really concerned with each other. We generically say we're sinners, but we never admit it to each other. And my concern then is what happens is when we have these particular focuses. I've heard people tell about Bible study groups where they pray for one another. What they turn into is gossip sessions, where, oh, we know about this one, we'll pray about that and pray for that. But nobody owns themselves, No one is open about what the issues are in their life. And so as a church, I'm fearful until we begin to be open with one another that it's going to be very difficult to really accept and be with others.
That's why I see AA, for instance, as a much more honest group than the church sometimes.
Please, and then Paul.
Oh, I was going to say something about the line he was talking about. You know, I, like you next to me, you know, you had a concern about just whether you knew, you know, you couldn't understand your moral feelings about homosexuality. I think maybe we need to just look at that Christ forgave, you know, and even whether the church would come out for or, you know, they don't need to come out for or against the act of homosexuality. They just have to realize that, you know, whether, you know, I don't think it's a sin, but whether they come out with that attitude or not, that we're supposed to be forgiving and that we all sin, you know, and that how can we say which sin is, you know, this sin is greater, you know, these people are homosexual and that's wrong, and just realize that we all sin.
My point was going to be that the thing that makes the difference is having a person like Frank who's willing to take the courage to come out, so to speak, and meet us and allow us to meet him. I mean, to know a gay person and speak with that person and know that person and find where they hurt, and oh boy, that makes all the difference, and will make all the difference, I think, in the church's future. And so I applaud Frank, and I'm grateful to you for that. And we ought to take advantage of that. What do they say, 10-15% maybe of the population is gay? How many people in the village? 500? 400? What's the 10? You know, there are a lot of other people besides Frank here who are gay. And we should hear their witness, and we should not close our ears to them.
I think the same thing with the feminist issues. I mean, it wasn't until we started paying attention to the people that said, I'm not going to that boys' club. My dad and I had a terrible relationship. He was never there. Who wants a God like that? Why do you call God Father? You know, I mean, I've heard all of that stuff from the women, and they aren't kidding. And I've heard some that were in seminary, and they were just kicked around like football squad, and it was because they were women, and they knew it. And my mother worked in real estate. She got kicked around as a broker and didn't even know it until my sister and I said, you know what the problem is? All your salesmen are men, and they don't give a rip. They wouldn't respect her enough to come into sales meetings. We said, that's the problem. She'd invite somebody to come and speak to her salesmen, and they wouldn't show up. And it was because she was a woman, a broker, and she had a real hard time with that, but finally admitted it.
Mm-hmm. Frank?
I was going to, in response to something that Paul said there, studies on sexuality done by Kinsey back a number of years ago indicate that probably somewhere around 10% of the general population is homosexual, lesbian, or gay. I don't know if those percentages hold true in the church or not, because the church has a tendency to run people off. Mm-hmm. And one thing that has really struck me is there's a church that has been formed in the last 20 years or so called Metropolitan Community Church. This is a church primarily of lesbian and gay people, not exclusively. That's not a requirement of membership, but primarily. And I have asked a number of people who are members of Metropolitan Community Church why they were members of Metropolitan Community Church. And I have just been amazed at how many people say, well, I used to be a Lutheran, but I couldn't be myself at a Lutheran church. Either the pastor, the former president of Lutherans Concerned in North America, was basically forced to leave two Lutheran congregations because it was discovered he was gay, and the pastor basically told him he wasn't welcome at communion anymore. This was pre-AIDS hysteria. AIDS did not enter into the the decision made by the pastor in any way. But a lot of people just don't want to stick around for that kind of harassment and insult and.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Yes, 10 o'clock,
Mark. Yes.
Well, maybe whether it is the kind of broad cosmic issues of whatever we want to talk about that we are not able to speak, AIDS, homosexuality, war, or whether it is those deep things within me that I find hard to say. I am afraid. And the fear is that if I say those, my world might be shattered. Mm-hmm. And I like to be in control of my world. It seems to me only in a place where the gospel is announced and that the world has something, somebody, something big enough to hold it together, can I have the courage to speak? And it seems to me that's a plea for us to speak the gospel clearly. Mm-hmm. And to announce that.
Thanks for that word, Mark. It is after 10:02. I'd like to thank all of you for coming to be a part of this and invite anyone who wishes to remain and to take advantage of the days that you have to talk further and learn more from one another. So thank you very much for coming.
Jerry, yes. I'll post the address of this Beyond War on the bulletin board.
Good.
Like more information.
Right. And if anybody has resources of this kind that they'd like to share, that's
Lutheran's
a good place
concern.
To put them.
Yeah.
Lutheran's
Concern.
Lutheran's
Concern brochures.
Oh, you got it.
An excellent Fortress publication, Silent Scream, written by a woman out of her experience of incest. A great resource. So share resources with one another, too. Thanks for coming.